I want to talk with you about impermanence, what I've learned about it, and some of my thoughts. So I want to start with a Zen teaching, a story in the Zen tradition. A man walking across a field encounters a tiger. He fled, the tiger chasing after him. Coming to a cliff, he caught hold of a wild vine and swung himself over the edge. The tiger sniffed at him from above. Terrified, the man looked down to where, far below, another tiger had come, waiting to eat him. A mouse, little by little, began to gnaw away at the vine. The man saw a luscious strawberry near him. Grasping the vine in one hand, he plucked the strawberry with the other. How sweet it tasted. It actually strikes me as very poignant, because that's what's always happening. We're always here. The past is always over. And this moment is always about to dissolve into something else. And so the way that I understand the story is, this is the moment, this one right now. And this one, don't hold the vine with one hand, which takes courage. We want to cling on with two. We have to be vulnerable. Hold the vine with one hand. Reach out. What's happening here? Be present for it. And taste it. Because it soon will be gone. The whole thing will be gone. One of the functions of being lost in our thinking is it's a defense mechanism for our really being here now, which is vulnerable. But it's worth it, because it's really all that there is. The dropping into and feeling into impermanence can bring up a lot of feelings, because we know from our life experience and then from observing it as it happens that everything passes. But it's worth that effort. People on the spiritual path are often referred to as spiritual warriors. And why is that? We're not putting on armor. We're warriors because we're taking it off. When we're remembering, either through direct experience or through the chant or through a reminder of practice, when we're remembering about impermanence, we're more willing to have the courage to be fully here, to fully engage what's happening. Hafiz says, death is a favor to us. But we have lost our ability to see that. When we remember that death is near, and it is for all of us and for all our loved ones, it gives us the courage to taste the strawberry, to be fully here, to not be glazed over. And it also gives us the courage to play with reality. Everything's changing. Whatever's happening, it will be gone. So while we're here, we can dance, we can play, we can throw off the fear of being judged. This is from Nagachang Rinpoche. Death, impermanence, things that go wrong, laughter, color, light sparkling in puddles, cars breaking down, relationships ending, falling in love, all are the play of existence, the movement and change that is reality. It is only experienced as unsatisfactory when we try to stop movement and change, or see movement and change as painful. Once we have a real understanding of the cause of our experience of samsara as unsatisfactory, we can engage with it in a light-hearted manner. We play with our life experience rather than feeling like a victim of our circumstances. You know, things happen to us and way down in the lizard brain, we learn that it might be safer to freeze than to really be here. And maybe sometimes it has been safer to freeze than to really be here, but now is the time to defrost. It's interesting that this moment is the only place where anything can ever really happen. But this moment is rife with possibility. If one of us suddenly decided to get up and start doing the hokey pokey, we could. This is the place for it. Now. It's fear that stops us from really taking our lives. But we're here now. This is it. This is the place. It's so fun, you know. It can even be really simple, you know. Like, this is where we can push against the jail cell here of our conditioning. I also want to share with you, while I'm talking with you about impermanence, to the understanding that to me it's really important that impermanence brings with it loss, for sure, but it also brings with it the relief in the understanding that whatever's happening will change, and so when things are difficult, we can have that certainty that it will change. And it gives us more capacity to have patience to be with the difficult. I'm going to read you this is from the Loka Vipatti Sutta, directly from the Pali Canon Buddhist teachings, translated by Tanisaro Bhikkhu. Monks, these eight worldly conditions spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. What eight? Gain, loss, status, disgrace, blame, praise, pleasure, and pain. These are the eight worldly conditions that spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. For an uninstructed, ordinary person, there arise gain, loss, status, disgrace, blame, praise, pleasure, and pain. For a well-instructed disciple of the Noble Ones, there also arise gain, loss, status, disgrace, blame, praise, pleasure, and pain. So what difference? What distinction? What distinguishing factor is there between the well-instructed disciple of the Noble Ones and the uninstructed ordinary person? Listen close, monks, I will speak. As you said, Lord, the monks responded. The Blessed One said, gain arises for an ordinary person. They do not reflect, gain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. They do not discern it as it actually is. So it is with loss, status, disgrace, blame, praise, and pleasure. Pain arises. They do not reflect, pain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. They do not discern it as it actually is. Their mind remains consumed with the gain. Their mind remains consumed with the loss, with the status, with the disgrace, the blame, the praise, the pleasure. Their mind remains consumed with the pain. They welcome the arisen gain and rebel against the arisen loss. They welcome the arisen status and rebel against the arisen disgrace. They welcome the arisen praise and rebel against the arisen blame. They welcome the arisen pleasure and rebel against the arisen pain. And as they are thus engaged in welcoming and rebelling, they are not released, I tell you, from suffering and stress. Now, gain arises for a well-instructed disciple of the Noble Ones, and they reflect, gain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. They discern it as it actually is. And so it is with loss, status, disgrace, blame, praise, and pleasure. Pain arises. They reflect, pain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. They discern it as it actually is. Their minds do not remain consumed with the gain. Their minds do not remain consumed with the loss, with the status, the disgrace, the blame, the praise, the pleasure. Their minds do not remain consumed with the pain. They do not welcome the arisen gain or rebel against the arisen loss. They do not welcome the arisen status or rebel against the arisen disgrace. They do not welcome the arisen praise or rebel against the arisen blame. They do not welcome the arisen pleasure or rebel against the arisen pain. And thus, they abandon welcoming and rebelling. They are released, I tell you, from suffering and stress. This is the difference. This is the distinction. This is the distinguishing factor between the well-instructed disciple of the Noble Ones and the uninstructed ordinary person. Gain, loss, status, disgrace, blame, praise, pleasure, pain. These are conditions among human beings that are inconstant, impermanent, subject to change. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no resistance. Their welcoming and rebelling are scattered, gone to their end, do not exist. Knowing the dustless, sorrowless state, they discern rightly and go beyond becoming. So that chant we were doing, all things are impermanent, they arise and they pass away. To be in harmony with this truth brings peace. It's a teaching the mind to understand that clinging to the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant is not a skillful way to bring ourselves happiness. Instead, allowing what is to be here and bringing it into awareness as it arises and passes away. We're not creating the conditions for suffering anymore. We're just courageously welcoming what's here now inside us and external to us. Remember what Rumi says, even if it's a great wind of sorrows knocking down all the furniture in your house, greet it at the door laughing, for this too was sent as a guide from beyond. But we have to be awake to it if we're going to greet it at the door laughing. And we can find the courage to be awake to things if we understand this truth of impermanence. It's not going to last. Well, if I feel angry at someone, I can let my ruminating mind keep me separate from that person. Or I can remember that that other person and I are both subject to change. And I may not, that death could come at any time, and am I okay to let things be as they are? And sometimes I am, and sometimes that remembering of impermanence impels me to release and let go, see where the good is, and stay in relationship. Things keep changing. So, there's a song that I have felt for a long time is a really beautiful Dharma song on this topic of impermanence. And it's Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now. And I would love to sing that with you. It's on the inside of the last page of the handout. And I've given you the version with the added verse by Pete Seeger, which I left in because I think it's a beautiful sort of in praise of consciousness, in praise of love, kind of a last verse to add to this reflection on impermanence. Bows and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I could have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's clouds' illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds at all. Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, the dizzy dancing way you feel. When every fairy tale comes real, I've looked at love that way. But now it's just another show. You leave them laughing when you go. And if you care, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow it's love's illusions I recall. I really don't know love. Tears and fears and feeling proud, to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. But now old friends are acting strange. They shake their heads, they say I've changed. Something's lost, but something's gained in living every day. I've looked at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all. Daughter, daughter, don't you know? You're not the first to feel just so. But let me say before I go, it's worth it anyway. Someday we may all be surprised. We'll wake and open up our eyes, and then we all will realize the whole world feels this way. We've all been living upside down and turned around with love unfound until we turn and face the sun. Yes, all of us, everyone. Thank you. Okay, so impermanence. I want to have an opportunity now to leave a little open space in case anybody has any questions, comments, or thoughts that they wanted to bring in to our community, our circle. Where did I find which one? Isn't that lovely? Yeah, the Pete Seeger verse is in the most recent edition of the songbook Rise Up Singing.
I have a question. It's a little bit off topic.
Okay.
Why isn't everything called practice?
We can do that in our minds, and I think we should. If we call everything practice, then in what we would consider an ordinary day, bringing in as much mindfulness and as much compassion as we can. I'm with you. We could call everything practice. Yeah. Yes?
The Thanissaro Bhikkhu Sutta translation, is that on his... On the access to insight.
It is. It's on the access. Yes. So Carol's asking about the teaching about the eight worldly winds from Thanissaro Bhikkhu, and that's, you can Google that, and it's on the website Access to Insight, which, by the way, is a wonderful website just to peruse and read. You know, when you're wanting some good calming dharma, it's a good place to go. Yes.
Did you come up with the phrase "jail cell of our conditioning"?
I did, as far as I know.
So powerful.
Thank you.
Write a song about it.
I will. Yeah, I will. Yeah, but that's what it feels like when we bring our mindfulness right up against our conditioning. We can feel it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then here we are in the moment with our conditioning. That's the chance where we can start to make those structural changes, the pushing up against. Yeah. You might not be able to tell, but I'm actually a pretty shy person, or I've been a very shy person. And it's with mindfulness that I've been able to begin to change that and have more eye contact and, you know, just we learn certain things when we're kids and then that becomes habit. And it's really in the moment where we have the chance to change. Thank you. Tell me your name again.
Janet.
Janet, I remember you from last time. Good to see you. Yes.
I'm trying to intellectually understand that may be the wrong way to try and come to the understanding of what is the bliss in living in the moment. Like you talk about that coming, but I mean, living in the moment, I mean, and how everything changes, you think it'd be terribly depressing. Ultimately.
Yeah, I hear you.
So,
why would there be joy and bliss in that? Yeah. Yeah, so what's your name?
Chris.
Chris is saying, you know, living in the moment and noticing that everything is impermanent and changing, that would be depressing, and where's the joy in that? Yeah. So my response to that, well, first of all, where is the joy? If we are constantly coming back into the present, we begin to notice that there's something really loving in the chair or cushion underneath our seat. It begins to become apparent that there's some kind of supportive energy here that we can drop into. And so something as mundane for me right now as the cushion under my booty is actually a really joyful thing, just the simplicity of being supported by the earth. So there's a kind of an urgency in impermanence, knowing that we're here together and I'm going to be on a plane back home when I blink my eyes, you know. The urgency brings a sense of appreciation and tenderness. And then beginning to see that everywhere, so that every time we see a hummingbird, we know the hummingbird will be gone. So in that moment of seeing the hummingbird, the sense of love that comes out of our heart for it, because we've been stripped of the illusion that things are constant. This practice strips us of that. It is vulnerable, and yes, it's humbling. But after a while, it's not that we don't grieve, because of course we do grieve, but after a while, it's not a depressing thing because it's just the truth. If it weren't the truth, then we wouldn't bother with it. But because it is the truth, our defenses against the truth are not only not helping us live, they're actually numbing us or dulling us from seeing and appreciating what's actually happening. The sense of separate I and security and all that stuff isn't helping us. If it were, then you know, we wouldn't need to be doing these practices. But it's actually causing us to be isolated and confused. So it is odd, you know, it is odd, but it's just what is. And mindfulness allows us to bring awareness to it. But the sense of gratitude and joy and amazement isn't an overlay to a horrible situation either. It's what actually arises as we begin more and more to see what's happening. We can see the beauty more. I quote this often, so you may have heard me say this before, but somebody asked a 80-year-old Tibetan monk who'd gone into the monastic life as a child, which is common in that culture. When he was 8 years old, he went into the monastic life, and he's now 80. Someone asked him, "Why do you continue practice?" And he said, "So I can really see the little purple flower by the side of the road." when we have this sense of impermanence, another thing that the Buddha said is practice as though your hair is on fire. And it doesn't mean, you know, not meant to mean anything scary, but more what is this practice about? It's about really seeing and being with things as they arise, which is a form of love. And there's just a lot of joy that arises. You can begin to feel it in your heart. For really simple things. I mean, breathing, which becomes so important to folks as they die. Well, it can become important to us now, and we can begin like on an afternoon when you get home from work or a day out on errands, and you're sitting on the couch, and you're in that in-between place between getting home and doing something else while you're at home, and you're just there. Just sitting there, noticing your breathing, can be so joyful. Because it's a treat. It's a special thing to get to breathe. But we're not taught to see and appreciate it. Also, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I have a really wonderful life, and there are certain things that are sometimes difficult and in a mild kind of way. And one of those things is I teach elementary school music 3 days a week. And sometimes, especially this time of year with my fifth grade boys, sometimes they would way rather be out on the yard playing basketball than in my music class. And they show it with their behavior. And now I'm remembering impermanence, and I'm really looking at the boys who are misbehaving. I respond to them in a completely different way than I would if I were just coming out of my conditioning, which would be to send them to the office. Realizing that soon this music period will be over, and here's this beautiful living, restless living being in front of me. And he'll be gone soon anyway. And so it just helps, mindfulness, it helps us have some options in the moment about how we're responding. So I'm going to ask you in these last 15 minutes before the walking period, I'm going to get into dyads, and we're going to explore what's hard about this topic of impermanence, what's challenging about it. So with your partner, one will be the speaker and the other will be the listener. If you're the listener, please don't respond verbally or with touch. But just stay really, really present to your own internal experience and to listening. If you're the speaker, you are going to have 3 minutes to talk about what makes this hard, this teaching on impermanence. What makes it hard? Okay, can you find somebody to pair up with, please?